Welcome to the Babysitter's Fight Club, where the first rule is you don't talk about Fight Club. Instead, you talk about the Babysitter's Club series of books by Anne M. Martin. I'm Brooke Sukumel.
And I'm KK Brady.
And we're friends who met while working in the publishing industry, where we bonded over our shared love of books and pop culture and smartly stupid jokes. And that's what we aim to serve up here in this podcast. But you may be wondering, why the Babysitter's Fight Club? First of all, it made us laugh. But beyond that, I'm a former PhD student in literature, and I believe that plot at its essence is really the introduction, exploration, and resolution of conflict. And I think that the way that both children and children's literature grapple with and fight back against serious issues in the world is really often overlooked. Earlier this summer, I found myself with some unexpected free time, which led me to do a lot of self-reflection. And one of the things that really struck me was the impact that children's books and the Babysitter's Club in particular had on my life, how what I read shaped who I was and who I became as a person. So I decided to revisit these foundational texts in my and so many other people's life to explore the messages that I received and the lessons that I took away. And since so much of the series is grounded in female friendships, I asked KK if she was down for a little socially distanced nostalgic book club with me.
Yeah, I was so happy to be invited to do this podcast with my good old buddy. I was a little too old to have experienced the Babysitter's Club books in real time. I'm a few years older than Brooke, so I was sort of reading Anne of Green Gables and Little Women and those kind of stories. But I knew about this series and I knew about the impact of this series. And, you know, younger people had often talked about it. So I was curious to check it out. And I was an English major, an avid reader. I just love character study. And I love to read, especially like female centered books, books written by women.
By women for young women.
That's right. And books written by late in life lesbians.
Right.
Yes. I love to be some late in life lesbians. And who late doesn't? In life lesbians was like the 80s. Come on.
And late in life lesbians love you too. So feelings mutual. So I think you're going to really relish this series.
So you're saying Anne Martin's going to love me.
She is.
You're saying.
She is. Absolutely.
I can't wait. I can't wait. So yeah. And not only did I want to sort of engage in these really popular books that I had missed out on, but I would basically read the phone book if Brooke suggested it. So
that's our next episode. Spoiler alert.
Reading phone books with KK and Brooke.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next episode won't be on the phone book. Sorry, but it will.
Everyone's turning off
the podcast now. Everybody, we just lost our entire audience.
But it will be about phone calls.
Ooh, it will be right? Soon enough. Yeah. But it will also not be about the TV show, just to clarify that right off the bat. So since we're both 80s kids, we really want to stick specifically to the primary sources in this particular podcast. And I am totally in love with the fact that this series is experiencing yet another resurgence with the rebooted TV show on Netflix. But since this is all new to KK, and since this is really grounded in what are the messages that people that grew up in the 80s and 90s like us, the sort of messages that they received from the literature that they were reading at that time, we're just going to stay focused on the root text, sort of keep it to the pure, uncut 80s action.
We're Babysitter's Club purists.
We absolutely are. Although, you know, there's absolutely a potential that we'll eventually expand our focus to the TV shows, movie and such, do little special episodes here and there.
All right, then we're classic Babysitter's Club.
Yeah. Babysitter's Club OGs.
Yeah. If we needed another podcast title, there it is.
Put that in the back pocket.
That's right.
But first, the book that started it all. August 1986 brought us so many things. Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet and Lionel Richie's Dancing on the Ceiling. The cinematic masterpieces Stand By Me and Howard the Duck. And the debut of Howard Stern's radio show. But most importantly, it also brought us the first Babysitter's Club book, Christy's great idea.
Yes.
So to give everybody a refresher, I'm going to go ahead and read from the back cover copy. And I quote, Christy thinks the Babysitter's Club is a great idea. She and her friends Claudia, Stacy, and Marianne all love taking care of kids. A club will give them the chance to have lots of fun and make tons of money. So 80s right there.
And make tons of money.
Make tons of money.
Well, we'll get into this. We'll get into, capitalism and feelings.
As you do in America in 2020. But nobody counted on crank calls, uncontrollable two-year-olds, wild pets, and parents who don't always tell the truth. And then there's Stacy, who's acting more and more mysterious. Having a babysitter's club isn't easy, but Christy and her friends aren't giving up until they get it right. End quote.
Woohoo. Some editor just earned their salary.
It's a very tight six sentences.
It's got some like nice 80s wackiness too. You know, like nobody counted on crank calls. I expect like a penny whistle, like.
Can add that in post.
Yeah, please.
So we're going to discuss all of this and more problematic 80s nostalgia in this episode. So let's dive into the Babysitter's Club book number one, Christy's Great Idea.
Long time Babysitter's Club fan, and it was really fun for me to go back and reread it and have all of these feelings that I remember feeling when I was, 8 years old and first getting into this coming back to me. But as someone who is experiencing the joys of the Babysitter's Club for the first time, talk to me. What was your take on Christy's Great Idea?
Oh man, it was a warm 80s hug. It was just
the best kind of 80s hugs.
Yeah, no, it was, it just brought me right back to that time. And definitely reading it as a grown up was less nostalgia and more concern for 80s children who are now me, basically, adults.
Right, right. We're learning so much about why we are the way we are.
Correct. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, a lot of it just does not age well. So
like what stood out to you as problematic?
Well, here's a quote directly from Christy's Great Idea. She said, when David Michael gets like this, it's important to ignore him and pretend everything is fine. So I'll give you context of what that meant. Is that meant that David Michael was devastated because none of his siblings could babysit for him. And his mom is working all the time and he's a latchkey kid. And, basically he's not getting enough attention, clearly.
Right. Getting passed around from one sibling to the next when Kathy can't come over.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then like his mom like calls all these babysitters who can't babysit and he's basically starts crying. Just a perfect little time capsule of the 80s right there.
That moment, though, it was interesting that you singled out that particular moment. That was the one that really jumped out the most to me when I was rereading it as well, that we both kind of honed in on that early on. I think that's in chapter one?
Yeah, it's early.
Yeah,
well, because this is the crux of how the Babysitter's Club comes to be.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the genesis of Christy's Great Idea.
That's right.
That's the moment where the great idea crystallizes, and that great idea is the Babysitter's Club. But the thing that stood out to me about that, and I love that you're looking at it from David Michael's perspective, as we all should. Really, as the youngest person, the most impressionable person in that scene. But for me, looking at it from Christy's perspective, and frankly, looking at it as somebody who is kind of watching Christy's response. And that's one of the reasons why I love this book series so much, which, we'll get into, is just the fact that each book is told from the perspective of that Babysitter's Club member. So we get to get inside the head of Christy, and then we get to get inside the head of Claudia, and then we get to get inside the head of Marianne and Stacy, and spoiler alert down the road, Dawn, etc. And I just love how that makes it possible for you to understand these characters when they are characters in someone else's story, they're richer in that way because you can see who they are, their own perspective of themselves. And then you also get to see how others perceive them. But looking at it, you know, as this first book, the first chapter of this first book series that goes on for decades and is still with us today, I love how you really understand that when you're reading this now as a grown-ass woman, going back and seeing the messages that you were getting as a child. But the thing that really led her to this great idea was her empathy, was her seeing that her mom's pizza was getting cold because she was too busy having to call around, trying to find somebody to care for her kids. And Christy feels bad for her mom, that her mom, who works all day and comes home and brings them this pizza, she's not able to eat. You know, she's sad because she looks over and she understands that her brother is feeling bad right now about this, like is perhaps blaming himself for this. And so she recognizes the way that these people that she cares about are feeling, and she wants to solve that problem for them. Like she thinks about what could we do, and not just like what someone could do to solve that problem, but what could I do? Like she takes that initiative to solve it. And I really love that.
Well, she is a budding lesbian. So, you know, we are all about initiative.
True.
It's what we're known for.
Right, right. You're going to erect that tent yourself.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, I remember you and I were talking about how you felt like being a reader as a child, like developed your empathy.
Absolutely.
And as you were talking, that's exactly what I was thinking about, like giving the perspective of all these different characters is like helping a young kid develop their empathy and developing their ability to have that like theory of mind, right? Where like other people think different thoughts, other people have different insecurities, and everyone's kind of fighting their own battle. So that's cool. I really like the way you describe that.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that I don't think it really hit me as much until, you know, we're talking about it right now. And I'm just trying to think about, well, what other books in the 80s were out there that did that? What other, were there other series that were told from a range of perspectives where you keep coming
back? I was thinking
the
same. I don't know. I mean, there was a rash of books after this, you know, like there was the Sweet Valley High. I think that was after this. I don't know. And then like Audrey and I were thinking about like what other YA books were there. You know, there was like Ramona Quimby, Judy Blume, but that was always from like a one character perspective. Right. It certainly wasn't multiple.
I have opinions about Sweet Valley High.
Another podcast. It's going to be our break off. Well, do you want to talk about the plot?
Yeah, let's dive into the plots.
Because I just had fun like summarizing the plots in like one or two sentences. And even that I thought was really fun and instructive. So it was like really funny to me to just write out these sentences. And I thought you might enjoy them. All right. So, and there's like many, many plots. I have like five plots.
Okay.
All right. So plot A, I say, Christy unleashes the Babysitter's Club as a distraction to her mom's deep pain. And Watson's and her mom's deepening relationship. And they all learn lessons about business management. Plot B, Christy gets a taste of dog sitting and Claudia learns about extinguishing behavior through operant conditioning. I'm not only a psychotherapist in training, but I was a dog trainer. So this was like right on my alley. So basically the dogs are running away from her. Everyone's instinct is to chase the dog. But actually what you want to do and what Christy did so well is she ran the opposite direction. And then also when the kids were losing their shit, she basically ignored them and started reading a book. That's operant conditioning, boy. I mean, I will say I was a little stunned that Christy did not like dog sitting.
Mm.
I mean, what kind of budding lesbian is this?
It is interesting. I've been doing a lot of research on Anne M. Martin, and I wonder how much of it is just, I don't know. I'm like, is it because Anne M. Martin seems to be like very much a cat person? But then you've got Louie,
right?
Oh,
we'll get into cats. We'll talk about Boo Boo at length.
But then you get it, like, she loves Louie, right? Like, she loves her collie, Louie. But maybe it's just a matter of she has this idea in her head of what her club is and what they do.
And it is not for dogs.
Right. It is very much not for dogs, as we see again when later on, you know, Mrs. McKeever calls back and she's just like, no, we don't want your business. which is a choice.
Sometimes you gotta know what you don't want.
This is true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. She's like line in the sand. But but yeah, no, you're right. Like, why not dogs? And I think it's because Christy is just like, that's just not what we do here at the Babysitter's Club.
All right. So C plot, Stacy and Sam begin a romance and Christy tries to unpack heteronormative culture and beauty standards. Mm. I was very struck by, there's one line where Christy's like, I guess Sam is a hunk and I guess Stacy is a foxy, exactly.
A gorgeous Stacy. Hunk and a foxy chick.
That's right. That's uh-huh. right. And I thought to myself, don't worry, Christy, you know, someday you're going to understand why you have no interest in boys and some lesbian will love your sensible outfits, your business acumen, your sports skills and your ability to flip your eyelids.
It's true. It's, yeah. All of those things that's are pluses. Saying. Every yeah, single one
right
of those
woman.
Things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I love that. I actually tabbed that too in my book where, you know, she said, when I heard that later, I thought about what they looked like and I tried to figure out what they saw in each other. And then parentheses, I have absolutely no interest in boys, of course, like underlined, absolutely yeah. no interest, but that she realized that kind of information might be useful one day.
Yeah. So. And of course, you know, that's going to resonate with me as a budding lesbian. I was Christy 100% right. good at sports, you know, having no idea what my sister was doing with the opposite sex.
Right. Flipping your eyelids.
Well, I never could flip my eyelids, but I could do a lot of really fun eye crossing. I'm a pro.
When you read about flipping your eyelids, did you think about flipping?
I sure did.
Did you do it?
I mean, if I wasn't a middle-aged woman with like allergy crunchy contacts, I would have tried it.
I seriously considered trying to flip my eyelids.
Why don't you try it? You want to try it right now? Should we take a second?
Should we try to flip our eyelids?
Okay. I can't. I'm having such bad allergies, but
yeah, I don't.
All right. So Brooke is now giving it a whirl.
I tried to do it when I was younger and I could
it's not for straight girls.
No, I could never flip my eyelids, but I could also never do a cartwheel. So
right.
kind of square in the middle. Neither Christy nor Stacy here.
Was Stacy cartwheeling? Does that come later?
I would just imagine.
Sure.
That would be, I mean, because Stacy is like peak 80s girl.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like probably her sport.
Would all, right. Cartwheels. Would all 80s girls strive to be?
I'm a competitive cartwheeler.
Right. She's got a gold medal in the cartwheel.
All right. Should I tell you about the next plot?
Please do.
Okay. This, I think we're going to have to do a deep dive on. All right. So Marianne meets Watson's kids. A cat is body shamed. And a strong woman of independent means is dubbed a witch. So I got a serious theory about this. Do you want to hear it?
Please.
All right. So my theory is that Morbida Destiny is Christy's latent lesbian panic. So the name is a tip off to me. Morbid comes from the word disease, which mm-hmm. at the time, homosexuality was still a disease in the DSM. And Destiny, you know, she'll try to keep it down, but she can't escape it. And like maybe Morbida is just like a sad old lesbian who lost her partner that did all the home repairs.
The one who could flip her eyelids.
Exactly. And then Morbida mm-hmm. is like in this totally oppressive heteronormative culture. Mm-hmm. And maybe she's growing weed in the garden. And that's why the cat got fat.
Right. Turned into profits.
And that's why the cat was like freaking out. Like the cat goes over to Morbida's. And then he comes back and he's like running around like a motherfucker.
Right.
Maybe she's growing weed. Like right. someday they're going to love Morbida. They're going to be like, dude, we thought you were a witch, but like you're just super cool lesbians growing weed.
So is that why she's like upstairs and you see the window shade snap down and then snap back up? It's just like her getting glimpses at her past and her past getting glimpses of their future.
Oh, damn. That's deep, girl. Wow. I love it. I'm here for it. And then, of course, the last plot is the big reveal, which is diabetes.
Right. Which is so weird.
Which is so timely because we've just lost Wilfred Brimley.
R.I.P. sir. Like sidebar, A, I didn't realize he was still alive. And B, I didn't realize the man was 85.
Yeah.
Which means that like back when he was kind of like playing all of his old man roles.
And he looked like 80 years old. He was like 42.
Yeah. Or like maybe Cocoon is real. Like Wilfred Brimley has been an 85-year-old diabetic all this time. And now he's looking around at what the world has become. And he's just like, I'm out. You know, this is not for me. And I get it.
You know, I think Stacey could have used some Wilford Brimley support really for sure. Have. I mean, she's struggling with this.
She needs to check her blood sugar, check it often, eat her oatmeal, you know?
That's right. Okay. Stabilizes your blood sugar. Here was the hilarious thing to me. They said they moved from New York City because of her diabetes.
Yeah.
It's not passing the smell test.
It is strange, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you're talking about all of the sort of undercurrent of homosexuality that is, you know, just beneath the surface there for Christy. And yet the big secret reveal is that Stacey has diabetes, which who cares? Like, who fucking cares?
Exactly.
That's
enough to move out of New York City?
Right. Like, you gotta flee like
it's a pandemic? That's so strange.
Right. Yeah, it is so bizarre. And I remember being confused about that as a kid too, with like, why would somebody be so ashamed of diabetes that they wouldn't want to let anybody know they had it? But then who am I? Like, I didn't have juvenile diabetes. So how do I know how somebody might feel about it? And I get the being different, and your best friend here in your new town is this like total junk food addict.
Right.
Who is stashing gummy bears in her pencil case and jawbreakers and her sneaker box and all of that stuff.
That's a heartbreak, man. Everybody That's
has
a heartbreak.
Secrets in this.
Well, it's so funny.
Except for Christy, when you think about it.
Oh, but Christy has the biggest secret of all.
Right, and she doesn't know it. She doesn't know it yet.
This is where I think Ann Martin doesn't know it yet.
Right.
So like Ann Martin's like, there's a big secret. Ha, it's diabetes. Sorry, you thought it was something else? Absolutely not.
No, Stacey's diabetes.
So it falls a little flat.
Yeah, everybody's like, and, you know, dot, dot, dot. Like, that's all you got for me, lady. So you've got Stacey with her diabetes, deep, dark secret.
Right.
You have Claudia and her secretive nature with her junk food.
Uh-huh.
You know, like she like has to stash the candy everywhere. And then also she points out that like she dresses wacky, but she doesn't wear her skeleton earrings that jangle around. Like she takes those, you know, she puts those on at school. She doesn't want her parents to see that. So I think with Claudia, she is trying to come into her own as like she's obviously the one who's going through the most obvious sort of pubescent changes. Like Christy talks about how ever since seventh grade started, they never were super tight with Claudia before, but now they've definitely got different interests. Claudia wants to like talk
with
about
the boys.
Doesn't want to play tetherball with them at recess. She wants to watch the boys play basketball.
That is really a shame because tetherball is a fine game.
Tetherball is legit.
Game.
It is.
I mean, if that isn't like the crystal of an 80s childhood, you know, it's like you're like punching a fucking volleyball into your friend's face.
right,
like around a huge metal pole, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's just
on concrete, unsupervised.
It reminds me of those jabby lawn darts the parents used to play with.
How did any of us survive the 80s
even without diabetes?
But then you've also got Marianne who isn't allowed to even talk to her friends on the phone.
Right.
Instead, she has to communicate like the hostage that she is.
With Morse code.
With freaking Morse code, with a flashlight upstairs in her room at night with her friend across the street.
I mean, like, here was my question was, I mean, everybody in this whole book needs therapy. Like, don't even get me started. We could do an entire podcast diagnosing. I have some working diagnoses going on already. Mm-hmm. But why didn't they get some walkie-talkies? I mean, that's what me and my bud next door did in the 80s.
Right.
We had, like, we just brought our asses to service merchandising and bought some quality walkie-talkies.
Well, I think you had more freedom than Marianne.
Yeah.
I mean, Marianne can't even spend $3 of her own babysitting money
for pizza.
On pizza.
Right. She's not
because
getting
her dad wants her to save it for college or quote unquote clothes that like he dictates as he dictates also whether or not like she can't even wear her hair now. She has to wear her hair in braids. You know,
this is, you know, now that you're describing it, it's very disturbing.
Isn't it disturbing? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's really like her, like Marianne's dad is just like keeping her
right,
like trapped in a frickin' box, like trying to obviously can't deal with the fact that he's got a prepubescent daughter.
Yeah.
And he's alone.
Well, he has some complicated bereavement going on. That's what we call that.
For sure. But, you know, his daughter's 12 years old. So poor stunted Marianne. She'll come around a little bit later. But man, oh, I felt so bad for her in this first book.
Yeah, she is kind of like a sad sack character. And she really gets lost, even like with the author trying to like bring her forward. I still think for me, I'm just like, Marianne, like I glaze over.
And it's funny that you say that because Anna Martin claims, so there's a profile of her in Vulture that came out, I think it was like 2016. And she says in that interview that she's a Marianne. Huh. And I've got a different version. So there's been so many different sort of like redos of the Babysitter's Club
yeah.
over the years. And when they came out with them and sort of like new editions in the 1990s, there was a new interview with Anne M. Martin in the back. And she talks about the way that this book series came about, et cetera. She mentions that Christy is her favorite babysitter.
I assumed she was Christy. Like, yeah. I thought this was a Louisa May Alcott Joe situation totally. Straight up.
Totally. I don't remember whenever it was she came out, like Anna Martin came out, I don't know, like a decade ago or so. And it was just like, oh, that made so much sense because it was very obvious to me as a kid, even before I knew what gay was. Yeah. I didn't know what gay was, but I knew that like whatever gay was, that's what Christy was.
To me, wow. Right?
Which is, but it was like, that's cool.
I mean, you know? Just like that's very early, especially in the culture of the 80s to be having those thoughts.
Yeah, like there was just something different about Christy.
Yeah.
I just knew that Christy was
oh,
not
shit.
Like,
story of my life, girl. That should be like, right? That should be my autobiography subtitle.
You know, so it was like, oh, well, it just made sense. And I think that there was something that I had read previously that talked about how, you know, she identified with Christy. But then reading this article from 2016, and she talks about how much she identifies with Marianne. Yeah,
shocking.
And the writer of the piece talks about how Anne M. Martin is just painfully shy.
Huh.
Still, like to this day.
Interesting.
Just incredibly
so
shy.
So like Christy was sort of like who she wanted to be.
I think yeah. so.
Well, and Christy is a fucking baller. Like she's the one that comes up with the Babysitter's Club. She has all of these like ideas for like how to make it better. Like really smart ideas. I was consistently impressed with like her quality control.
Right. Right. And it's funny that you say that because reading it again now, you know, gosh, this would have been almost 30 years since yeah. over 30 years, you know, since I would have read it the first time. I remember reading it and we talked earlier about who do you identify with there? Now that the Babysitter's Club is back out on Netflix, you see a lot of the BuzzFeed quizzes
totally.
And such, you know, like which babysitter are you? And I remember even thinking about that when I was a kid reading this for the first time. And I knew I was a Christy. I knew I was Christy.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to be Christy. Huh. I didn't want to be Christy at all. I wanted to be Claudia. I wanted to be Stacy.
And what was it about those two that made you want to be them?
Stacy, to me, as I mentioned before, was like the aspirational, what the ideal girl was at the time.
Because she's a foxy chick.
She's a foxy chick, even with her diabetes. Not, and for me,
she's
I was
a
like,
foxy
ooh,
chick
diabetes.
With diabetes.
Just ooh, diabetes. But like diabetes kind of makes you cool. You know what I mean? It's like, it's
yeah,
like
you're
there's
something different
sort of
about you.
Different about you.
She's from yeah. big New York City.
Right. I mean, obviously, she's just so glamorous. I kind of had the same reaction to Stacy as a reader that Marianne did to her with everything's like, wow.
Oh,
like,
I see.
Oh, wow. You took the subway to Coney Island.
Okay, can we talk about that? Why is she Please. Taking so many trains to Coney Island? The B, the D, the F, they all go right to Coney Island from anywhere in Manhattan.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe Anne M. Martin had never taken.
Well, she probably
the
hadn't
subway.
Lived in New York City until she started making like crazy money. Or
yeah,
maybe
lived kind
or
of
maybe
on
you're
outskirts.
Saying right, because like she wasn't rich before she wrote this, I'm assuming.
No, they said she was a teacher and then that she also was an editor.
Oh, okay.
And what's really interesting is that this book series was not her idea. Oh. So she had written a few books for Scholastic previously. Right. And her editor at Scholastic pitched this to her.
Whoa!
And said, hey, what do you think about doing a 4-book series? So it was just initially meant to be just 4 books.
From like the 4 perspectives?
I don't even think that she even said the 4 perspectives. So, and this is in the 90s version of this first book that I have, where there's this extra sort of letter from Anne M. Martin, and it's a dear reader. And she talks about like how the Babysitter's Club came to be about and mentions that in 85, she had just left her job and she used to be a teacher and started to write books for kids full time. And apparently in this interview that I read with her from Vulture, so she was 30 years old when she started writing The Babysitter's Club.
Right.
And she mentions that she had been a book editor too. So I'm not quite sure what her publishing history was like, but that the editor just pitched really the title to her. So just said, hey, would you write a 4-book series called The Babysitter's Club? And so she had to figure out what that would be about, what shape it would take. And so it was her idea to make it about a business run by a group of friends, she says. Huh. And so she came up with 4 different characters and decided to write each book from the perspective of each of those characters. And she said that she based Christy on her best friend from when she was growing up and Marianne on herself. And so it's really interesting that the character that's based on herself is the character that
gets lost,
feels least fleshed out.
I mean, that makes sense too, in a way.
Yeah, because it's hard to like go there.
Yeah, and also like you are the observer, right?
Right.
And so like Marianne could play that role of being the observer and the others are more the actors.
Right.
That is really interesting.
Marianne will come in later on to save the day.
What? Oh, right. That, I haven't read that yet, but I'm super looking forward to that.
Stacy is what, to me, was what like society tells you you should aspire to be. You know, and so that was the message I think I was picking up. Like, she's tall, she's thin, she's blonde with a perm, as you know, everybody, probably not even Ogilvy, right? Like, she didn't do that. Her mom didn't do that.
What is Ogilvy?
Her bathroom herself. Oh, Ogilvy perms? It was the at-home perm.
Oh, shit. I didn't even know there was such a thing. That sounds dangerous.
It almost as dangerous as the at-home hair highlighting kit.
Oh, shoot.
That the hair frosting kit that I did that I had a really not brilliant idea to do myself.
Did you have hot sticks? Am I getting this right? Did you have hot sticks?
Not hot sticks. I had a spiral curling iron. I had a flattening iron. I had, we had hot rollers. We had many different size of hair curlers.
Damn.
But yeah, Ogilvy was at-home perm that you could do. But I think Stacy probably got it done in
professionally,
Manhattan,
of course.
She was so fancy. Yeah. So like Stacy is who society tells you you should want to be. And Claudia was who I wanted to be. Me personally.
Yeah, she's an artist. She's cool.
Yeah.
She dresses like Milli Vanilli.
She doesn't, or at least puts on a show of like not giving a fuck.
Right.
And I love that about Claudia. Although I know you've got feelings about Claudia too, so I'm sure we'll talk about that. She's not without her problems. That is for sure. She's also a problematic character.
Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
On why Claudia is problematic. I think the one scene that I read that really struck me as, well, all of the scenes in the book strike me as very real.
Yeah.
I think that's why I loved this series so much. I think that's why this was what I would spend my babysitting money on.
Right.
You know, have my mom, like I would drop me off at the mall. I'm going to go straight to Walden Books.
I was just going to say Walden Books. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, I had a choice between Walden Books and B. Dalton, but Walden Books was
the go-to, obviously.
so good. And I knew exactly where they were, and I would just make a beeline for
it. Right next to the Spencer's, right near Claire's, across from Auntie Anne's. Pretzels.
Yeah, all of those stores were on the second floor of Westdale Mall. And I think that's why I never went to B. Dalton, because it was on the ground floor. Like, ground floor was more adult stuff. Upstairs was more like kid stuff.
Yeah, so the party's at.
Yeah, it's where they had the store where you could go and get like stuff screen printed t-shirts. Oh, yeah. You know, custom screen printing. Oh, so awesome. Glamour Shots was also really close to Walden Books. And so I always pictured Stacy as like your ideal Glamour Shots girl.
Obviously.
But I think that's why, like, I would spend so much time and money invested in these books, because it just felt real to me.
Yeah.
Even the little things, like school gets out at 2:42.
Right.
You know, just the little minutia where it's like, yeah, there are really weird start and end times to classes. I think it did a really good job talking about the highly imperfect relationships that kids have. Yeah. A lot of books I remember reading, their depiction of friendships just didn't necessarily ring true to me, because they were either so idealized or so, like, when there was conflict, you didn't necessarily understand where it was coming from. It would kind of feel out of the blue. Whereas this, you understand Claudia is Christy's friend of proximity.
Yeah.
Like, Claudia hangs out with Christy and Marianne because they're on her street.
Yeah.
If they didn't live on her street, you can tell they wouldn't hang out. And everybody has those friendships, right?
Yeah.
As a kid.
Yeah. And you make a really good point too, in terms of like, they also really understand each other. Like, they understand their vulnerabilities. And then, like, occasionally in a fight, they might attack those vulnerabilities, like human beings do. And in their stronger, better moments, they're sort of holding those vulnerabilities as friends, right? But, like, it is cool to see, you know, the kind of, like, rupture and repair that they go through in the end, where they have the big fight over Stacy, and then they kind of come back together.
Right.
Which feels pretty real, too. You know what I mean? Because at that age, like, you're always fighting with your friends. Like, everything's very dramatic. And then you kind of forget about it and you go to the mall, you go get some glamour shots.
Yeah. And I think that that is not something that was, at least at that time, I didn't see that honest reflection of my life, even though this is still in many ways idealized. You know, there's a lot of problems that kids have to deal with that aren't addressed in these books, but there's also a lot of things that kids deal with that I had never seen.
Yeah.
In books before, and that insecurity, that feeling of instability with your friendships.
Yeah.
And I think Claudia is probably, not probably, I think Claudia is like the most destabilizing force there. You know, she's kind of the linchpin. They come to her room.
Right.
Like, she's the only one with her own. I mean, the fact that Claudia had her own phone line.
Oh, please.
Amazing. Right. Like, that's why she's the coolest. Cause you're like, that's who you want to be.
Right.
You want to be, you know, the girl who has her own phone line in her room. And Claudia, where she is problematic, it was in the way that she sort of confronted Christy. Like, you see her taking her new friend, who is the cool friend.
Yeah, that's pretty garbage.
Side,
especially when technically the new friend did lie.
She did lie.
I mean, that's
she
garbage.
Did lie. Right, right. And so you've got like these two separate confrontations of Christy confronting Stacy about something, and Claudia immediately jumping to Stacy's defense.
Right.
So, like, for instance, when the first time was when they first meet Stacy, and Stacy isn't having the junk food because of the, you know, spoiler alert, diabetes.
Diabetes.
You know, she asks, "How much do you weigh?"
Did she ask that? she said, "How much do you weigh? It's not healthy to diet if you don't need to lose weight."
Right.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So it wasn't how much do you weigh in like a shaming way.
Right.
But, you know, there's probably a better, like, "Oh, I'm concerned about you." But, you know, you're 12 years old.
Sure.
You don't know shit. Do you know about
Oh, my God. And let's not even get into 80s fat shaming. Oh, my God.
Oh,
that's like a pox on this society, you know.
Absolutely.
The amount of horrible fat shaming in the 80s. Homo shaming and fat shaming.
So much shaming of things that now it's like kind of great to see, like, the positivity movement coming around.
Yeah.
Again, it's like, how much of that is we were raised with this and we saw that it was bullshit and we, you know, opted to reject it. So hopefully kids growing up now won't have to deal with that same absolute bullshit that tormented you and I. And I think everybody else that we grew up with that didn't have a naturally fast metabolism. But you know, so the way that Claudia just sort of like jumps to Stacy's defense.
Yeah.
I think, especially when you're looking at it from Christy's perspective, that sort of like raised my hackles.
Yeah.
Even though Claudia was the cool girl that I wished that I could be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reading it now, it's like, oh, like what's that all about? But then you think about the fact that like, well, Claudia would have her own insecurities too.
Right.
Like every single girl in this book has their own insecurities and it comes to light and you understand it. Like they're very realistic. They feel, they ring very true and no one is a perfect character. Like there's no quote unquote Mary Sue, you know, the Mary Sue persona of it's like where the author writes the character from like their own perspective, but they make that character perfect in every way. And nobody in this book is perfect.
Right. So in other words, like men writing women characters.
Exactly.
Is what you're talking about.
Exactly. Exactly. Or women writing the kind of characters that they think that their male editors
would
want or their male salespeople
yeah,
want.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that Anne M. Martin's editor that, you know, pitched the series to her was a woman.
Yeah.
You can tell this is a book written, conceived of by women. Four young girls. And I think perhaps Anne M. Martin's sexuality might have something to do with the fact that it doesn't feel like anything is for the male gaze.
Right.
Like none of this is being written for any or for any sort of striving for what men might want or what they might need. Like every single, almost every chapter in this book passes the Bechdel test.
Of course. Yeah.
So for that to be, when you get something, when you get literature and art that is grounded in female relationships and purely female relationships, not men's interpretation of female relationships or females acting in a way that they think men would want, I think that that really helps young women develop a better sense of self.
No doubt.
A healthier sense of self. So.
And the one thing that's occurring to me as you're talking, it's really interesting the way that the friends are able to communicate with each other and talk about feelings and how things make them feel. They can't do that with their parents.
Absolutely.
Right. So like they're the only like true, honest relationships you're seeing in these books are actually between the friends, between the babysitters.
Right.
Whereas like there's a lot of repression and denial and just like not talking about things going on with parents. And then you're having like, you know, crazy societal things going on, right? Like you have like shifting gender roles and like divorce rates are skyrocketing and like nobody's talking about it. But like this is a place where like they can talk about what's going on between them.
Yeah. Although I think that the relationship between Christy and her mom is interesting because there's a lot to unpack there too. But I think that they do attempt.
Yeah.
You know, to make that connection.
Yeah, and there's some talking about it. You're right.
Yeah, I don't think that they really get there, but there is an effort there.
Yeah.
There is an acknowledgement that of things. But I mean, that relationship is a little tricky.
Yeah, I think I'm operating on 2020 awareness of emotions.
For sure.
Right. Because like they never talk
just
about
not the 1980s.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like that's what. So we were going to have a section where we said who wins, who loses. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll go into it. Who loses? Feelings. Feelings lose. You know, like there's like not a single. How did that make you feel in the whole book? Which like, oh, man, I lived through the 80s millennials listening and it tracks.
Yeah, definitely.
The idea of what was happening maybe was discussed, but nobody actually says, okay, you're upset and scared because your dad has moved away and like you fear losing your mom. You know, all I can think the whole time is like, oh my God, if somebody would just sit down with any of these kids and like have a discussion about their feelings around this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but then the Babysitter's Club would have never existed. So who won?
Right.
Capitalism. Capitalism
isn't that
wins,
always
man?
The way. That is the story of America, right? Who wins?
Well, here's
capitalism.
The story of America.
Who loses? Emotion.
Yes. Yeah.
Just, yeah. Yeah. Sense of
it's
self.
Like we can't deal with our feelings, so we're gonna make some money. We're gonna elevate our business game.
Right. Although, you know, this is the thing where the good business comes about from a recognition of somebody else's feelings.
Yeah. That's a healthier frame.
So it's like, just the do we just need Christy Thomas to like run
the world?
Is Christy Thomas Elizabeth Warren? I think there's an honest conversation to be had there, you know? And then, let's pool our resources together so that we can all enjoy this delicious pizza. And Stacey, you can have a salad and a Diet Coke and an apple.
Yeah, and like your brother is crying in the corner because he can't find a babysitter. She's got a plan for that.
She does. Oh yeah, I would vote for this woman.
Yeah,
I'll tell
obviously.
Because I was thinking about what are they fighting? I came down with the complexities of interpersonal relationships.
Oh, shit. Yeah,
right. That's the theme that comes through again and again. So what I sort of identified as like the A plot was from a sort of a structural perspective. It's the formation of the babysitter's
yeah.
club. Like that is the theme that ties everything yeah. together. And the B plot to me, the thing that seemed to have the most focus on it and have sort of the most packed into it was Christy trying to deal with her mom's relationship with Watson.
Yeah.
I love how Watson's cast is like, he's the good right. dad. Christy's dad is the bum who
like
ran
moved
off
to California with a new wife.
Yeah. Hasn't called them in a year, yeah. you know, and that gets mentioned. It's an aside, but whew, there would be a lot to unpack there. But as a 12-year-old girl, would you actually be doing that unpacking in that time?
Certainly not.
Coming from somebody who was in a similar experience at the time? No.
Yeah. Certainly not.
You would just be looking for any sort of distraction. And then the C plot was the nuances of pubescent female friendship dynamics. Yeah. Christy mentions that she and Marianne just finished playing with dolls last summer.
Right.
And her friend Claudia, who was part of their trifecta, is all about, I just want to talk on the phone about boys. When you are going through that and just seeing how your friends are sort of maturing
yeah.
at different
right.
paces and wondering, what do I have to hold on to? Particularly when you're in a situation where your mom is dating. We know that Watson isn't the first guy she's dated. Christy talks about how she's ran off other guys because she doesn't want anything to change at home.
Oh, I forgot that.
She's had, you know, so much upheaval in her life.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, now it's like you might settle down with this guy and then we all have to pack up and move and get used to a whole
yeah.
new family dynamic. It's just too much when she's already playing surrogate mom at least one day a week for her brother.
Right.
And then for pay for other people's kids. And it's always, with few exceptions, Watson and then Mr. Johansson at the end there. It's the moms that are calling, right? Dads are not very present in this book.
That's true.
Except their absence
right.
or their problems.
Right.
Like Marianne's dad, who never appears directly.
Is controlling her whole life. Yeah.
When he does appear, it's never in a positive context.
Right.
So, you know, it seems like to me, they're fighting all of this. How do I make my place in a world in relationship to other people?
Yeah.
And that is something that I think every single one of us fight
yeah.
all the time. That never goes away, but you really first start to realize it when you're about the age that they are in this book,
yeah.
which is 12 years old. And I think the tool that they use and that Christy, even though Christy is like, I feel really bad for her when she talks about she needs to like watch her mouth.
Yeah.
Like her mouth gets her into trouble.
Sure.
She's too outspoken. Even when it's just so damn hot
Decorum.
In an air-conditioned classroom. Right. She's just like, okay, good. I can get up and hopefully get some fresh air. And, you know, she gets in trouble for that. But she immediately feels bad.
Yeah.
Which, again, it's like, she feels bad for a lot of things that it's like, I don't know that you need to feel bad about that. sweetie, like, it's okay, you know, but she does have a lot of empathy. She's very focused on other people. Even like when she is called to go finally at the end, watch Watson's kids, which she had been saying, I'm not going to do for so long. She wonders to herself, even though she doesn't like Watson, she doesn't want her mom to be with Watson, but she wonders, how does her mom feel that Watson's rushing off to be with his ex-wife in the hospital? Like, she's always thinking about other people. And when, you know, they have fights, like with Stacy, first time that she sort of meets Stacy and she's like, well, does your mom know that you're dieting?
Yeah.
Like, why are you dieting? And it's out of concern.
Yeah.
For somebody else. So I think that there's, you know, the tool that she uses that I think that they all use to some extent, and we'll see it in later books, is they really use empathy as their tool, which as a 12-year-old girl growing up in the 80s, good on you.
Seriously.
Because we were not really given, you know, the tools for empathy.
Yeah, that's in a way surviving that despite kids are the now. Culture.
Totally.
Yeah. It was not an empathetic time. It was far from it.
No. No.
And like, you know, it is funny how like, it's pretty revolutionary to read those books in the 80s because everything was from like the white male killer perspective. You know what I mean? So to have this kind of like female voice with a lot of empathy in it is like, that's pretty revolutionary in a sense.
Yeah. In a range of female voices.
Right. Yeah, not just one, right? Not just like, oh, this is a girl.
Yeah, and they're different.
Yeah.
Like, all of the characters are different. They have shared interests, but they're all unique individuals who, over the course of the series, get fully fleshed out and get, you know, for the most part, increasingly complex. And I just think it was really groundbreaking, and I'm really grateful to have had this series in my life.
Aww,
to have had something that made me want to just get to know these characters and to give me a different perspective. And I think they gave me like tools and ideas.
Yeah.
You know, just seeing the way that Christy took initiative. I remember being like, well, when I went to a new school, I was like, oh, let's have a school newspaper.
Right.
And we didn't have a school newspaper. So I like go to the principal and like, let's start a school newspaper for elementary school. Because, hey, I had read in a book where a girl decided she was going to start her own, you know, business, and it worked out. So I can do it too. So I think that there's some really good lessons in this book, along with the obvious problematic things that we see as well that you've touched on.
Yeah, I love it. Such a good frame.
What was your most 80s moment? What jumped out at you?
Well,
took you back?
Certainly the quote about David Michael. Mm-hmm. I pulled that out as my most 80s moment. No doubt about it. Where you want to ignore him and pretend everything's fine. And also the way the dogs are all just off leash. I mean, I know it's a tiny thing, but
dogs
I was like,
wild.
Damn.
Dogs and cats.
Oh, my God. So, like, that tracks, too. I mean, we had a golden retriever that just, I mean, he was intact. My parents didn't even get him neutered, and he just did his own thing. I mean, he'd be gone for, like, 3 weeks at a time, and we'd be like, oh, Corky's gone. He'd come back missing a tooth.
Corky.
He'd come back missing a tooth, and my parents shrug. Oh, well. I mean, he's probably impregnating, like, 1,000 dogs. Oh. Anyway, that was so 80s to me, you know, because... you're barely, you know, parenting the children.
Right. Lack of responsibility for others. Yeah. I mean, I thought there's so many great 80s moments.
Yeah, please.
Like you said.
What did you find?
It's like, it's a warm 80s hug, and it's warm in that you're like, oh, I remember that. But it's also a little cold because you're like, oh, that was a problem. Like, you know, if you're a 6-year-old, a key.
We'll
be fine.
Oh, can we talk about the basic premise? Like, have your 12-year-old babysit? Like, I mean, you know, now people are going on to care.com. You need a fucking graduate degree.
Absolutely.
To, like, babysit for children.
That was still very shocking for me. And it's still something that I'm trying to get acclimated to. Coming from the Midwest, where by the time I was a 12-year-old girl babysit, I was, like, veteran, right? Like,
well, I read at the Babysitter's Club at
$8 an hour.
So you've like, I mean, you've got your business practices down. You've got, I mean, like, you are a honed weapon. You are
exactly
you're like a babysitting assassin at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And then to come out to the Bay Area where people have kids when at a later age and have more resources, at least, you know, the circles that I'm in. Now, granted, I'm revealing sort of my class position by talking about how, well, my friends who have kids and going through like all of the steps that they go through to get a babysitter.
Yeah.
And the amount of money that they pay and the interviews that they do and just all of this. And I was like, I didn't even know some of the people that I would babysit for. I didn't know who they were.
Yeah, that's
dangerous.
You know,
dangerous. They lived in the town. And so it was just like, oh, it was like a friend of a friend needs someone to watch their like screaming toddler. You're 10. You can take care of it. They'll pay you $2 an hour. And, you know, all right.
You know, I can't help but thinking about, I mean, like one of our favorite podcasts is My Favorite Murder. We all know, you know, the crime rates in the 70s and 80s were just like through the motherfucking roof. So it's like... We'll get to that later.
Why did you need to lock your door?
Phantom phone calls. We'll get to that later, but
The whole premise of it is very 80s. But then the thing that really just like just warmed my heart was the school lunch.
Ah, right.
Sloppy Joe's, red Jell-O with canned fruit, a cup of coleslaw, milk, and a fudgesicle.
Sick.
Like the nutritious value. Michelle Obama would not approve at all, and they get it every Friday.
Friday's supposed to be pizza day. Come on.
I mean, that was just so 80s. That is such an 80s
lunch
meal right there. Right. Almost as great as the fact that when Christy's mom decides to tell her children that she has agreed to get engaged to Watson, like just the beautiful language that is used to describe that, right? We have agreed to become engaged. It's like freaking Jane Austen or something. That they're all just like eating whatever they can grab from the fridge, drinking Gatorade out of wine goblets and eating fried chicken and Twinkies and leftover SpaghettiOs.
Oh my God.
That is also...
It is very Jane Austen. Hey, and Morbitta is like the crazy first wife in the attic. You know,
totally.
We got a witch in the story.
Oh man, Morbid Destiny comes up. She plays a big role in another series.
Excited,
which is Karen Brewer gets her own spinoff series.
Get out of here!
Later on, Babysitter's Little Sister.
Oh my God!
And
yeah, my therapist told me about this.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Your therapist told you about Babysitter's Little Sister.
Yeah.
How?
Because I was...
I need the context.
Well, okay, the whole context is that my sound wasn't working on my Zoom call with my therapist. And I was like, oh, it's because I was working on my Babysitter's Club podcast. And she was like, what? And then she was like, you're doing a Babysitter's Club podcast? I was like, yeah. She's like, oh, yeah, I never read those, but I did read Little Sisters. And I was like, Little Sisters? I was blown away. And then she was telling me a couple of little nuggets from Little Sisters.
There's a whole generation, I think, like a pretty expansive generation, because these books first came out in 86, and then they went through a resurgence again in the 90s.
Yeah.
When the first Babysitter's Club movie came out.
Oh, I never saw any of this. I got to get on all of this.
Yeah. And now, and then, you know, they came out with like a graphic novel. Mm. Version of it about a decade ago, and obviously having a resurgence again. So it's kind of amazing to go back and think about how many young women and not so young women today have been impacted by this series and will continue to be in the future. And I love the fact that everything that I have read about the new Netflix series, which I haven't watched,
me neither.
Which we haven't watched yet because we want this to be a pure experience.
Exactly. We're going
to
do it a book at a time. Yep. Y'all. We're going to just go deep.
but I'm sure we'll get to it and we'll talk about it. But like everything that I've read indicates that they've really updated the series. Like, I know that they're still sort of holding true to the plots, but that, you know, they've added more diversity and, you know, it just sounds like they've tried to address some of the problematic things that we've noticed.
Oh, I'm so excited to see that eventually.
But yeah, it's just, it's really cool to see how this idea that an editor at Scholastic just had for a title, you know, got in the hands of the right woman.
That's beautiful.
At the right time. And thanks to that, I think some of us are more empathetic. Hey, maybe this is going to be, this is the Babysitter's Club generation.
Oh, shit. We are?
We're the ones. I think we are.
Yeah.
I think us, those and those beyond us, right? And I think that's why in the midst of everything that's going on right now, which is the absolute shit show of a world that we find ourselves in at the moment, I still have hope that we'll come out on the other side. Like this is the pain that has to be, this is like, you know, the cancer that has to be taken out of the body so that you can come together and heal.
Yeah.
And I think that people that were raised on books like this are actually going to be better positioned to lead us into a better future. See Christy Thomas / Elizabeth Warren.
All right, so there it is. Episode one, Christy's Great Idea.
What a journey.
It was a beautiful journey through 1986.
This book had everything.
This book has everything.
Has everything.
It has fat cats. It has foxy chicks and gorgeous hunks. It's got witches.
Closeted gay girls.
What more do you need?
It's got pizza.
And diabetes.
Or it almost had pizza.
Right, it almost had pizza.
It almost had pizza and diabetes.
It had a hint of pizza. It had the potential for pizza. Oh, and Diet Cokes and apples. So this book really did have everything. But the next book, book two, has even more. So the next episode is going to be our special crossover episode with the true crime fandom. Because we're going to be talking about book two in the series, which is Claudia and the Phantom Phone Calls. Very excited to dig into that with you next, KK.
I know. I'm so excited to dive into what appears to be the Golden State Killer, but I'm not going to spoil that too hard.
All right. Well, on that note,
keep on sitting.
But nobody counted on Craig Collins.